Hey, good to have all of you tonight, and we will move on into John chapter 9. This man lives in northern India, just right on the border with Nepal, and let's see, my note isn't coming up. I was counting on my note to remind me of what his first name is. But I'm not seeing my notes. So anyway, he's 22 years old and was blind from birth. It was a case of cataracts that just completely clouded his vision, made it so he could not see at all from the point of infancy. And they were able to correct that here not too long ago. He said it took him a year and a half to become used to sight. It's like when we hear a foreign language that we've never heard, we're not able to pick out the words or the sentences or figure out exactly what's being said, and it's just all a jumble. And he said it was very difficult for him to discern what was distinct from other things. And that, you can imagine when Jesus healed the man instantly who had been blind from birth, that part of the miracle was he adjusted to it. And I mean, you look at the passage and he seemed to have instantly adjusted to a complete new way of appraising the world that was around him. And that, but we're going to look at the one case of a man who was blind and then he saw. And so one who had been born blind, the man in the passage, in a portion that we'll consider on a later date, I pointed out that that just never had been done, that it clearly was a messianic sign. There are some things that we need to cover for introduction here on this passage, and so,
yeah.
Okay, it isn't minimizing, I'll just shove it over there.
Oh, I like this, John.
So this is a timeline of Jesus' ministry, and I tried to put Pesach, which means Passover, at equal intervals, so it's pretty close to that. And so those would each be approximately a year apart. So this is a timeline of Jesus' ministry. It started with his baptism late in the year 29 and then went on through April of 33, which was at Passover. He was crucified. 3 days later, he rose. And then in May 33, on Pentecost, we have the start of the church. Well, 10 days before that, he ascended to heaven. So this is a quick overview of his ministry. Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles, or also known as Booths, is the time period that we are looking at for our passage. So that was in the year September of 32. That's less than 6 months before, or it's about 6 months before he's crucified on April the 3rd of 33. So let's look at this a little more closely. This now is a timeline of John 7:1 through 10:21. The reason that I started at about 6 days before the Feast of Booths, or Sukkot, which is the Hebrew name for it, or Tabernacles, is that it would be a four-day journey for his brothers to walk down to Jerusalem, but there would have been an intervening Sabbath, and there would have been the necessity of going to a mikvah to be cleansed before partaking in the feast. So when we look at John 7, 1 through 9, where Jesus is interacting with his half-brothers, that would be approximately September the 4th. We are able to date when the Feast of Sukkot was that year, and we know what year it was. Jesus was crucified in 33, and so this is about half a year before his crucifixion. The feast started. Jesus' brothers presumably were there for the start of the feast, but he delayed. He said that it was not yet his time to go for the feast, but it was opportune for his brothers to go at that time. They were urging him to come down there. We're told in 7:1 that he had avoided going down to Jerusalem, going down to Judea, because there were plots to kill him. We have reinforcing evidence of this in Matthew. In Matthew chapter 17, we are told that there were the temple tax collectors, and they came up into Galilee and asked Peter if their master didn't pay the tax. Well, as you recall, Jesus had a conversation with Peter, and Jesus instructed Peter to go catch the fish, and the first fish that came up would have their temple tax. Now, let me explain this. The only people that paid temple tax when they were not in Jerusalem were those that had missed Passover. John has told us that Jesus did not want to go down to Jerusalem, John 7:1, because of the threats to put him to death. And so Matthew is reinforcing, indicating that Jesus indeed missed a Passover. And so Jesus' brothers were thinking, well, is he going to miss another feast? Is he going to continue to miss feasts? They're pressuring him to go down. He refused to go down at that time. But then we're told in verse 14 that he started teaching in Jerusalem at the midpoint of the feast. It's a seven-day feast. There also is a Sabbath that is attached to it at the end. But there are 7 days of the feast proper. Jesus showed up in the middle. And verses 7 through 14, that's 23 verses, we have Jesus starting to teach. I think the emphasis of that section is entirely upon September the 13th, which was a Friday, the midpoint of the feast. Then in 7:37 through 8:1, we pick up on the seventh day. You'll note in 7:37 that it says that it was the last day, the great day of the feast. The seventh day is the last day of the feast. I've appended after the feast is an eighth day, a Sabbath, but it's not regarded as part of the feast proper. All indications are that John 8:2 through 10:21 all occurred on the eighth day, on that Sabbath. Now, it would be a Sabbath no matter what day of the week it occurred upon. In this case, it was a Tuesday, but after the feast was over, the next day was a Sabbath. It was a holy convocation. And not all Sabbaths occur on Saturday. This is one of those occasions. There's an interesting little nuance as you look at John 7:53 that is an indication that we have this as the Sabbath. Notice that it said everyone went to his own house. Well, for 6 days, people would live in the huts that they built. This was commemorating the shelters that they lived in while they were in the wilderness. And so They would do that for 6 days. The reason that they did not do that on the seventh day, the great day of the feast, was that they would have to do work. They would have to dismantle the hut on the Sabbath. So therefore, they only stayed in there for 6 nights. As a result, the passage tells us everyone went to his own house. People did not go to their huts, their sukkot, or their sukkah, that would be the singular, that they had built during this time. The eighth day occupies John 8:2 through 10:21. Very interesting. This is where the focus of the passage is. Notice that the opening section, verses 1 through 9, was 9 verses. The day, the midpoint day that Jesus started to teach after he had arrived at the feast, occupies 23 verses. The seventh day, the great day, occupies 18 verses. This is the most detailed day in the entire ministry of Jesus, more detailed than any day that's recorded in Matthew, Mark, or Luke, and it is the most detailed day in John. 120 verses are devoted to this day. I'm going to give evidence at a later point that the day continues into chapter 10. But I would like to point something out here that is supporting evidence that the day does continue on into John chapter 9. Remember, the eighth day that is after the feast proper is a Sabbath. The Old Testament makes that very clear. But look at verse 13 and 14 in John chapter 9. We have the people that initially were confronted with the man who had been healed. They could not reach a determination as to whether he had indeed been healed, or whether it was just someone that looked like the beggar that they had seen before. So in verse 13 it says, they brought him who was formerly blind to the Pharisees. Now it was a Sabbath when Jesus made clay and opened his eyes. Now, dropping down to verse 16, some of the Pharisees said, this man, speaking about Jesus, is not from God, because he does not keep the Sabbath. So note, John chapter 9 happens on Sabbath. But it will turn out that it is exactly the same Sabbath that we had there in John chapter 8, the eighth day of the feast. We'll get into more evidence tying this together, that this is indeed the eighth day of the feast. It's not a Saturday, it's a Tuesday, but it still is a Sabbath. Okay, we've looked at timeline for the book as a whole, then we looked at timeline for 7:1 through 10:21. The reason for looking at 7:1 through 10:21 is that is in its entirety looking at things related to the Feast of Sukkot, also known as Tabernacles or Booths. But now I'd like to look at the timeline of that last day, the eighth day, the Sabbath that followed the Feast of Tabernacles. The passage divides up into four sections. Verses 2 through 11 are early in the morning that day. There we have Jesus teaching, and we see that in John chapter 8, verse 2. Now, early in the morning, the term that's used would say, would indicate at dawn. This is very early. Early in the morning, he came again into the temple, and all the people came to him. He sat down and taught them. After he embarrassed those that brought the woman and put them on the spot, they were trying to as we've seen, bring him under accusation of breaking Exodus 23:2, and he turned the tables on them. Exodus 23:2 looks at people who would bring about a miscarriage of justice by influencing other people to vote guilty for someone who was innocent. They thought that they would be able to catch him on this very charge by bringing in the woman, not bringing in the man, and trying to get Jesus to pronounce guilt upon the woman before a trial had actually been conducted, and without presenting all the pertinent evidence, and not allowing anyone to testify except the accusers. Jesus turned the tables on them. Those Pharisees walked out from the oldest to the youngest. But then we find out that there were other Pharisees that were there. This is clear from John chapter 7, making it clear that there were always, at this time, Pharisees who would shadow Jesus to try to catch him in what he would say. So the Pharisees that brought the woman left, but there were other Pharisees that were already there. And so the late morning then is described in verses 12 through 59 of John chapter 8. There Jesus is teaching, but his teaching is interrupted by hecklers, as we have seen. One of the key passages indicating his teaching is in John 8:31, "You shall know the truth," speaking to believers, that if these believers became disciples, they would know the truth and the truth would free them. Clearly, Jesus is speaking about a freedom that is not granted by believing, but it is granted as one becomes a disciple and abides in his word. Then John chapter 9, verses 1 through 41. This would be early afternoon. And this is healing the man born blind. Jesus left the temple, and as he was walking along through Jerusalem, they encountered this man who was born blind, and the disciples asked, what was the reason that he was blind? Was it because he sinned, or was it because his parents sinned? Jesus used that as an opportunity to teach his disciples, but also he healed the man. We'll be talking about part of that passage, so I won't get into detail here. But the end of the chapter set up a crisis that Jesus needed to address. The man had been excommunicated for telling the truth, and the people who excommunicated him knew that he told the truth. They had finally reached the conclusion that the man had been healed. And as he gave testimony that Jesus had healed him, lo and behold, that was the reason they excommunicated him, because they had already determined that anyone who confessed Jesus as the Christ would be excommunicated. John chapter 10, verses 1 through 21 has two tellings of a story that is dealing with the wicked shepherds of the nation, those Pharisees. And Jesus contrasted himself with them by calling himself the Good Shepherd. The most detailed day of Jesus' life. Something important that I have left out here. What is it? What is missing? There's something important that happens right at John chapter 8, verse 59. And it is essential that we look at that verse, because it will set up the context for John chapter 9. Jesus has claimed to be older than Abraham, that Abraham saw him, and Abraham saw his day and rejoiced.
It's actually 8:59.
And the people my slide says chapter 9, it should say chapter 8. Thank you, Ben. But Jesus has made statements claiming deity. And as a result of that, in verse 59, then they took up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself. We don't know if it's supernatural, he made himself invisible, or whether he simply ducked around a corner and they didn't see him. Text doesn't make it clear, but I'll pass my thoughts along in a moment on that. Going through the midst of them, and so passed by. Here we see some Pharisees discussing, where did he go? He was right here. Poof, he's gone. Either there was a miracle, he became invisible, or he ducked away in such a way that they lost track of him and he was gone. They didn't know where he went. And so they're kind of left holding the bag, unable to do anything about it. Now, we have something important, and this is a very strong tie between chapter 8 and chapter 9. We have the word parago, and it only occurs twice in John. It occurs once in the critical text, twice in the majority text. So if you have a New King James, you will have the entirety of verse 59. But in verse 59, therefore they picked up stones that they might hurl them on him, but Jesus was hidden, left the temple courtyard, and going through their midst, and thus bypassed them. Now, while bypassing them, he saw a man blind from birth. Notice I have two depictions of arrows. We're seeing the arrows going from the temple, and it would have gone along that path that's outlined there that has been actually uncovered archaeologically in recent years, going down to the Pool of Siloam. I will argue that Jesus met the man not far from the Pool of Siloam. Why would I say that? If you want a blind man to make a trip quickly, you don't send him on a long errand. So I would suspect that Jesus was not far from the Pool of Siloam. That would put some distance between himself and the Pharisees that wanted to kill him that were in the temple. But notice we have the word bypassed or passed by in verse 59 as well as in 9:1. I would argue this is one trip. Jesus left, and while he was leaving, he encountered the blind man. A lot of people, a lot of commentaries, a lot of pastors want to separate this out into two separate trips. And they have Jesus leaving the temple, and then someday later, who knows how long afterwards, maybe a month later, then he happened to encounter the blind man. No, this is one trip. He bypassed those people in the temple, and while he was on his way, he encountered the blind man. One trip. That is another argument that this is one day. This is the same day. It's a Sabbath, not because it's a Saturday. It's a Sabbath because it's the day after the seventh day of the Feast of Tabernacles. So that's an important detail. It helps set up the chronology that John 8 and John 9 are looking at the same day. It's not a separate day, even though many people assume that. Okay. We note when we look at the Gospels that Jesus did a fair number of miracles and had a fair number of confrontations with the religious leaders on the Sabbath. Now, I think one likely reason that one of the reasons that Jesus did signs on the Sabbath, besides the fact that it would set up opportunities to teach grace and to teach truth, because the Pharisees would get all upset, and it would give an opportunity for Jesus to teach, the Pharisees religiously counted their footsteps. Now, today we have apps you can even put on your wrist to tell you how many steps you've taken, and so on and so forth. They had to meticulously count how many footsteps, as they didn't want to find themselves on the Sabbath going too far to be able to return home. The fact that they would have come from home, gone to the temple, even if they wanted to find Jesus, they're not going to make a long search, because if they go looking here and looking there, pretty soon they're going to have their number of footsteps, and they're going to have to stay where they are. They're not going to be able to return home. If Jesus does a healing on the Sabbath, it's sort of like children's games where there's a base where you're safe. You step on base and nobody can touch you. And all Jesus had to do was walk further than the Pharisees were willing to walk, and he was safe. Okay. Something interesting occurs in Acts chapter 1, verse 12. It tells us that from Jerusalem to the Mount of Olives is about a Sabbath day's journey. And you look at that and you say, that's really not very far at all. Just to the left of the arrow would be what was regarded as city limits of Jerusalem. That distance, if a person walked further than that, they were in trouble with the legalistic rules that were in place. And so Acts 1:12 is kind of a handy passage for that purpose, that it explains that that's about the maximum distance that a person could travel. And don't forget, people would have to make a round trip, and so that's part of the issue. Okay, something that we have to make note of before we get into John chapter 9 is that on this monumental day, Jesus has encountered three different groups of Pharisees. Group one brought the adulterous woman to him to interrupt his teaching in John 8, verse 3. Then in verse 13, after that group left, the first group left, that is, there was an attack upon what Jesus said when he said that the one who follows him will not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. That same group of Pharisees ended up in 859 wanting to stone Jesus. But then in chapter 9, we run into another group of Pharisees. And that group doesn't initially run into Jesus, but at least some of them did later run into Jesus. You remember that after the man had been healed and the neighbors couldn't figure out, was this the same man that had been begging, or was it someone that just looked like him? Well, that issue comes up in verse 16. It's Pharisees that to whom the neighbors brought the man, and so they want the Pharisees to reach a determination. But lo and behold, in verse 40, we have Pharisees that are quite aware that the man who was blind had been excommunicated. Let's see how that becomes clear. Notice in 940. Now, let's back up a little bit. Let's back up to verse 35. Jesus heard that they, that is the Pharisees, of this man's synagogue, had cast him out. And when he found him, he said to him, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" He answered and said, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you." Now, this is very important because this is the first time this man has seen Jesus. He's met Jesus, he's heard Jesus' voice, and as a blind man, he would be quite capable of identifying people by their speech and other characteristics that would be observable to a blind man. So he recognizes this is the same man that had healed him, and now he knows that Jesus is claiming to be the Son of God, and so his answer is, "Lord, I believe." Now, I'm going to ask a question. I'm not going to answer it right now. We'll do that next time. Is this the moment that the man became a believer, or had he become a believer earlier? We'll talk about that next time. But he said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshipped him. And Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be made blind." We'll explain that passage next week. Then some of the Pharisees who were with him heard these words and said to him, "Are we blind also?" That would seem to indicate that they were familiar that this man that Jesus was speaking to had been blind. I mean, notice the word "also." Are we blind also? Okay, this man was blind. Are you saying that we are blind also? That would indicate that these were Pharisees that had been part of the meeting that had excommunicated the man. Okay, so note, we have group 1, group 2, and group 3. I argue that they are distinct groups, although there can be overlap between we have a larger group that had interrogated the blind man, but these are three distinct groups. On the right, I cross out the idea of them being overlapping groups, and here's why. Group 2 tried to stone him. Do you think that they would just be talking with Jesus or looking for stones and seeking to throw them at Jesus now that they had found him? But furthermore, there's another issue. Would the group 2 people be willing to walk all this distance to find Jesus? After all, they didn't have cell phones. How many false directions might they have gone looking for Jesus? How many footsteps would they have put in before they would have gotten here? This is not a case of overlapping groups. These are distinct groups of Pharisees. Josephus tells us that there are about 6,000 Pharisees. There can be distinct groups of Pharisees. They're not a monolithic group. It isn't that you see Pharisees and you say, three groups of Pharisees on the same day, that must be all the same people. No, it is not. They are distinct groups. So, all this is background here now for us to get into exposition. So let's return to John chapter 9, verse 1. We've already introduced that Jesus passed by as he continued walking further away from the temple, making it less likely that he would encounter those Pharisees that had sought to stone him. On the way, he saw a man who was blind from birth. How John knows that he's blind from birth, I would not be at all surprised if the man had expressed that directly to them, but furthermore, it came up in his discussion with the Pharisees, saying that it's never been heard of that someone who had been blind from birth has been healed. Furthermore, the parents brought that up. John has been brought up to speed on what had occurred. John knows about these things. John is recording it. But it was known to them even before this particular encounter, apparently, that the man had been blind from birth. So, in verse 2, it's a case of whodunit. That is, the disciples ask, who is responsible for this man being blind? Was it because of a sin of the parents, or was it because of a sin of this man while he was in the womb? Interestingly, Jesus is going to answer them, but the Pharisees also brought up exactly the same issue. Let's drop down to verse 28. After he made a defense of Jesus, in verse 28, these Pharisees reviled the formerly blind man and said, "You are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. We know that God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow, we do not know where he's from." Isn't that interesting? There were groups back in John chapter 7, as we discussed, that had claimed that they did know where Jesus was from. Remember, we talked about that and how many people would say, well, why doesn't John the Apostle say, well, Jesus is from Bethlehem? That's because that's not quite the right answer. Jesus' source is not Bethlehem. His source is heaven because he's God. He's eternal. It was that his humanity took form through birth in Bethlehem. But the argument in John is not that Jesus is a Bethlehemite. It is that he's the God-man. Okay, but notice, they're all focused upon the idea that the Messiah would come suddenly and know, poof, he's there. The man answered and said to them, "Why, this is a marvelous thing that you do not know where he is from, yet he has opened my eyes." Saying, I thought you guys were the experts, and you know, he did something that you certainly should be interested in, and you don't even know where he's from? There's a problem here. Houston, we have a problem. "Now we know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered and said to him, "You were completely born in sins, and are you teaching us?" And they cast him out. They couldn't deal with his argument, so they cast him out. But notice, they leveled the accusation that some horrendous sin was the reason that he was born blind. Exactly what Jesus' disciples also said back in 9:2, the passage that we're actually looking at this moment. Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Both the disciples and the Pharisees had the idea that all suffering is retribution for sin. That is not the case. That can be the case, as Jesus made clear to the lame man in John chapter 8, after he had healed him. He said for him to be cautious that sin could lead him to a worse predicament than the one that he's been healed from. He could have an even more serious physical ailment. Similar things were said by Jesus to the woman caught in adultery, John chapter 8. What's Jesus' answer? Said bad premise. Okay, this house wasn't built on a slope, but it clearly was built on what wasn't a very sound foundation, or else its basement has partially collapsed. Jesus is saying here, guys, you've got a bad foundation, a bad premise that's leading you to your question. You think that this is because of sin. This man's blindness was not caused by his sin, not caused by his parents' sin. Rather, it is for a purpose. His blindness was looking forward to the solution, not to its cause. In other words, his circumstance was brought about so that I could heal him and God could be glorified. Look at what he says in chapter 9, verse 3. The 9:3b. Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. So this man's blindness was an occasion for Jesus to do works of the Father, works that would glorify the Father. We're going to see later on that Jesus told Mary and Martha when he communicated with them after they had indicated through a messenger that Lazarus was sick. And he said, this sickness is not unto death, but it is for the glory of God, that the Son of God should be glorified through it. There, once again, we have a sickness that led to death, physical death, but it was not caused by something terrible in Lazarus. It was in order that it could bring about glorification of the Son of God, just like what's happening here. That's significant. What does he say in verse 4? I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. You remember how on a number of occasions in John's Gospel, Jesus says, my hour has not yet come. Jesus is using this to point ahead to the same thing. Night is going to be when an Old Testament prophecy timetable reached its conclusion and Jesus could be put to death. Jesus is saying, while it's day, while I'm alive, while I'm here on planet Earth, I need to do the work that the Father has given me. Jesus is giving indication that every minute of every day of his life as he walked on planet Earth was dedicated to doing the things that the Father had designed for him to do that day. Jesus is able to say at the end of his earthly life, that he has accomplished everything that the Father had sent him to do. You know, when Jesus said to Tetelestai, it is finished, many people limit that to he made full payment for sin. Well, yes, he did make full payment for sin. But there's a bigger picture in John's gospel. Jesus has said on occasion here in John's gospel that he was sent to do the Father's work and to bring it to completion. Interestingly, on some of those occasions, exactly the same lexical form is used that shows up in Tetelestai, that it is finished. He has finished all the work the Father has sent, not just payment for sin. But Jesus is saying, I need to do the things that need to be done before I go to the cross. It's important for me to do them. And think back. We are only 6 months before the cross. We looked at the timetable. Jesus has a ministry that's 3.5 years. 3 of those years have elapsed. Jesus is saying, I need to finish the things that need to be done. This man is an opportunity for me to do one of those works that God the Father has designed for me to do. Then he says, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Now, let's think here for a moment. This is the Feast of Sukkot. Remember? John 7:1 all the way through 10:21 is surrounding Sukkot, or tabernacles, or booths. One of the things that happened in that feast was that the court of the women was lit up. That was commemorating the pillar of fire by night as the children of Israel were out in the wilderness. That is not the light to which Jesus compares himself to when he calls himself more than once in this section the light of the world. The light that he's comparing himself to is sunlight. That's right there in the context, because notice what he said in verse 4. I must work the works of him who sent me while it is daylight. The night is coming when no one can work. His earthly works are done when he goes to the cross. He'll have a short 40 days that he'll be with his disciples after his resurrection. But essentially, his time of work on planet Earth is during the 3.5 years. He says, I need to do all the things that are set before me. He only has about 6 months left. It's one of the reasons that we looked at the calendar for his entire ministry. I should have that slide here as well. I did not duplicate it. So now let's consider the actual healing. In verse 6, when he had said these things, he spat on the ground and made clay with the saliva, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. And he said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. So Jesus has made clay with spittle and anointed the man's eyelids with it and told him to go and wash. Some interesting things come up in this passage. he sent the man to the Pool of Siloam. There is some fascinating archaeological news that has just come up very recently in regard to the Pool of Siloam. This is as much as has been excavated up to this point, but the Israeli Antiquities Authority was able to acquire more land, and as a result, the portions to the left of this photograph are going to be able to be excavated. So a much better picture of the entire pool is going to become available. This on the left was private property, and therefore they were not allowed to do any excavating there, but archaeological digs are now going to happen, uncovering the entire pool. We need to talk about this. You'll notice on the left-hand side I have put stair steps. The lower set of steps is like traditional steps that we have going from floor to floor in our houses. But what we have for the upper one with that yellow one is we have what are called platform steps. All water pools in Israel, ancient Israel, had steps into them. But it's important to figure out what pattern of steps occur. The pattern of steps that we have here has platforms, and that's easy to see here as you look at the photograph on the right. What's the importance of having platforms every so often? Well, at different times of the year, there would be different amounts of water that would be here in the pool. And so when you have platforms, this is where a person would stand as they would immerse themselves. So they'd be standing, and they'd go down the steps to whatever platform would be underwater, and then they would squat down into the water. And so if you have platform steps, then it tells us that it's a mikvah. It's a place where people did ritual cleansing. It's not just a pool for water supply. So that's just an interesting detail that tells us something about the Pool of Siloam, that it was for more than one purpose. It included for ritual cleansing. So this man has come here now to the pool, and he washes his face, washes his eyes, and he went back seeing. Okay, let's look at the orientation of this. If you look on the right-hand side, you see the Pool of Siloam, and then you see the temple, and the area that's here shaped sort of like Florida is part of the ancient city of David, where the original city of Jerusalem was, with the temple being built north of it. And so Pool of Siloam receives its water from a spring, and there was a lot of attention to that in Hezekiah's day back in the Old Testament, therefore making Jerusalem's water supply secure. You may remember that David was able to penetrate the city because the city was very secure, as the Jebusites were there, except for the water supply, and they were able to get in through there and take over the city. Okay, on the left-hand side, I've expanded the picture, and interestingly, what I'm going to be able to show you in the next slide is something that is also recent archaeological finds. I remember I've talked about how over time cities build up higher and higher in elevation. As the stone breaks down, and they end up building on top of the rubble, and so on and so forth. So you get layers and layers and layers like an onion. So that today in Jerusalem, the street level in the area of the Old City is 20 or 30 feet higher than it was in Jesus' day. So places where Jesus walked very often are underground today. Lo and behold, the pathway for going between the Pool of Siloam, a mikvah, a place where people would cleanse themselves as they were coming into the city on their way to the temple, because they had to be cleansed before they would be allowed to partake of feasts in the temple. Lo and behold, there is a pilgrim path that has been discovered in recent years leading from the pool to the city. And this is part of it. The fact that it's underground means that they've had to put in support walls, and that's what all this steel is, because there are buildings and so on and so forth that are up above this, because this all had been covered up in 70 with the destruction of Jerusalem. And since then, the city has continued to build up. Now, you might wonder, why is it in verse 7 that it says Pool of Siloam, and then he translates it, which means sent? Well, John's gospel makes a big emphasis that Jesus is the sent one. The sent one sent a man to a pool named Sent. The whole concept here is Jesus is reinforcing the notion he is the sent one from God. That's a statement. He is the Messiah. He is the Son of God. He is to be worshipped. Going to be building off this when he tells the blind man, he asks him the question, do you believe in the Son of God? When the man figured out that Jesus was claiming to be the Son of God, that the one speaking with him was the Son of God, he said, Lord, I believe. He is sent because he is God's Son, sent as the Messiah. Now the man went, he washed, and he came back seeing. Question. Why did the man go? If you were sitting on a corner, a very busy corner that had lots of pilgrims going by, remember this is feast time, so it's a time when it's likely that he would receive a fair amount of money. There is people would be going on their way to the feast, and they would give him money as they went on their way. He would find a good place. Now, you have someone who spits, puts clay on your eyes, and you've heard the discussion between the man and his disciples about, well, what was the reason that I was born blind? It's because I sinned, or my parents sinned. And this man says something very unusual. He talks about this man was born blind so that the works of God might be done in him. He must figure that this is a worthwhile thing for him to pick up and leave the place where he was collecting money and to go and wash. We don't have any positive indication that Jesus says, well, if you go, you're going to come back seeing. I believe that this man already was a believer. I'm going to make a case for that next week. I'm not going to steal my thunder, but I believe that there is plenty of evidence within this passage that this man was already a believer. And he's not going just because, oh, I guess I want to take a walk. He's going because he expects that there will be a good result for him doing this. I would argue he already was a believer, but we won't steal my thunder. Now we have something very interesting that happens though. In verse 8, therefore the neighbors and those who previously had seen that he was blind said, is not this he who sat and begged? Some said, this is he. Others said, he is like him. He said, I am he. Well, what we have going on here is that the people that are interviewed had seen this man regularly. These are neighbors and people who were aware, this man regularly sits at this spot and we encounter him all the time. So these are people who have seen him, and some even know his family, their neighbors. But how do we account for some of them say, well, this is he, and others saying, I'm not so sure, maybe he's just someone that looks the same. I think we get an indication of what's going on if we back up to something that happened earlier at this same feast. Remember, this is in Jerusalem, and this is the Feast of Tabernacles. This is Feast of Sukkot, or Booths. Let's go back to John chapter 7, which is only a few days earlier. I mean, this is the same feast, same situation, same time period, and let's start at verse 10. This is before Jesus showed up at the feast. But when his brothers had gone up, remember, Jerusalem is higher in elevation than any other population center in Israel, so everybody goes up to Jerusalem. Then he also went up to the feast, not openly, but as it were, in secret. Then the Judeans sought him at the feast and said, where is he? And there was much complaining or murmuring among the people concerning him. Some said, he is good. Others said, no, on the contrary, he deceives the people. However, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Judeans. People were afraid to talk openly about Jesus. Drop down to verse 25 of John 7. Now some of them from Jerusalem, the Jerusalemites, locals, these are people who have an idea of what the leadership really is doing. Is this not he whom they seek to kill? But look, he speaks boldly, and they, the leadership, say nothing to him. Do the rulers indeed know that this is truly the Christ? Verse 32, the Pharisees heard the crowd murmuring these things concerning him, and the Pharisees and chief priests sent officers to take him. okay, there's a lot of intrigue going on, and people are fearful. You know, this is like getting into a communist country and ending up saying something about the government that you might fear, I might get arrested. I might suddenly disappear. And so you have some people that say, yeah, this is the guy. He used to be blind, now he's not. And you have others that may be kind of protecting themselves, being careful. Do we have any evidence of anyone else being careful and not saying all that they knew? Oh, yes, we do. John chapter 9. Even the parents of this blind man are being careful about what they say. They throw their son under the bus. The Pharisees interrogated them. And so let's start at verse 18. But the Judeans did not believe concerning him, the formerly blind man, that he had been blind and received his sight, until they called the parents of him who had received his sight. And they asked them, saying, is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see? His parents answered them and said, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind. Now they start lying. But by what means he now sees, we do not know. Or who opened his eyes, we do not know. He is of age, ask him. They threw him under the bus. He will speak for himself. His parents said these things because they feared the Judeans, for the Judeans had already agreed that if anyone confessed that he was Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, he is of age, ask him. I don't think that these witnesses that are saying, oh, he just looks like that begging blind man. After all, they were neighbors and ones who had seen him before that he was blind. They're being careful. They're saying, there are too many people around here that'll turn us into the Pharisees. They were lying. They were saying, we're not willing to commit. We're not going to say that a miracle happened. We're going to protect ourselves. No, no, no. They say they're going to excommunicate anyone that confesses Jesus. I'm not saying a word. It's like Sergeant Schultz. I know nothing. They knew much more than they were willing to admit. But now the question is, how well did the man see? Interestingly, people have a tendency to kind of embellish the story. You know, something happens, and this man was just told, well, okay, here you are sitting begging. Jesus anoints his eyes, says, go over to the pool of Siloam. And this man did not add any details. He didn't embellish the story at all. He just laid out the facts. That's all he did. We'll make note of the last statement in verse 9. He said, I am. I am that one. I'm the man who used to be blind. Therefore they said to him, how are your eyes opened? He answered and said, a man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and I receive sight. No embellishment at all. This is a reliable witness. He's allowing any and all glory to go to Jesus. And he's not afraid of what might happen to him for confessing the truth. He sees very well. But if we ask ourselves, why was he willing to go? To even let Jesus put clay on his eyelids. Would we imagine that he knew nothing about Jesus before this? I don't think so. After all, his parents knew that the Judeans had already, at that synagogue, reached the determination that they would excommunicate anyone that confessed Jesus as the Christ. Clearly, it is public knowledge what Jesus is claiming to be. It is so public that the officials at their synagogue issued a warning saying, if you want to be able to do business, if you don't want to be blacklisted, you want to still be able to be in the synagogue and not have your name stricken from our records, you better not say anything good about Jesus. The parents knew what Jesus was claiming. This man is very astute. I would argue he also knew. He was willing to go because he knew what Jesus claimed. And I think he was already a believer. The follow-up question then was, where is he? He said, I don't know. Jesus sent him off to the Pool of Siloam. Jesus went somewhere else. He has not yet seen Jesus afterwards. Jesus didn't tell him where he was going. He didn't see where he was going. No embellishment. This man is an honest witness. All glory is going to Jesus. So, this particular passage is an illustration of Jesus as the light of the world. It is his sixth sign. Chapter 11, we're going to see Jesus raising Lazarus. Then we're going to see his crucifixion and his resurrection. At the Feast of Tabernacles, Jesus proclaimed that he's the light of the world. And he illustrates that by healing a man born blind, something that no one else had ever done. A true messianic sign. He did that as a response to those that thought he was blaspheming when he said that that Abraham had seen his day and rejoiced. It was the ultimate answer to their challenge. He is indeed the Son of God. He is the Messiah. Any questions?
Hey John, this is Joseph. Yes. How did How did Abraham see Jesus' days?
Abraham saw clear evidence that God was going to keep the promises that he had made. I think that when Isaac was born, he had very clear indication. Both he and Sarah had laughed. Neither one of them could fathom that. And if God would do that, and he promised, I will be back at this time next year. And lo and behold, he said, when he did come, that Sarah would be with child. There may have been further revelation, but I would say that that would be sufficient for Abraham to say, this is a down payment promise that God has made.
John, I have a question.
Yes.
Can you explain 9:4b to me? Night is coming when no one can work?
Yeah, that is figuratively looking ahead to his death. Well, by illustration, they didn't have incandescent lamps or fluorescent lamps or LEDs or anything like that. Basically, you did your work during daylight. It was insufficient light to do very many types of work once it became dark. But he's using that as an illustration. Day is while he's here before the cross. Let's turn forward to John chapter 12, where Jesus is going to make the same John chapter 11, he makes exactly the same picture. I'll start at verse 7, when Jesus told his disciples, after there had been another attempt in Jerusalem, John chapter 10, to stone Jesus. So Jesus said in John 11:7, let's go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, lately the Judeans sought to stone you, and are you going there again? Now, obviously they were concerned about Jesus, but if they were going to have to accompany him, they were concerned about themselves too. You're going to take us to that dangerous place? I mean, they want to kill you, and they don't like us much either. Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? Now notice, he's not talking about the 24-hour day, day and night. He's talking about daylight hours. By the way, you might, I'll throw this in just for fun. You might say, well, what about right now when it's midwinter? We don't have as many hours of daylight. There are more hours of daylight in the summer than there are in the winter. Ah, yes. They used sundials. And with a sundial, you have 12 hours, but the length of an hour changes. Daylight hours, there are 12 of them in the summer, but each hour is a little longer than an hour of daylight is during the winter when you're working on a sundial. So there were 12 hours every day. But notice what Jesus is saying is, I'm safe because it's daylight. Daylight is the time before the Old Testament prophecy that allowed him to die would run its course. On Palm Monday, John chapter 12, the timetable expires, and Jesus stops saying, my hour has not yet come, and he says, the hour has come, and he says it once in chapter 12 and once in chapter 13. So he says, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, that is daylight, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if one walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. What he's saying is, it's daylight, I'm safe. I can go to Judea and I'm not going to die. Nighttime is a reference to his death.
Thank you.
Hey, John, I have a question.
Yes.
So in Mark chapter 8, when he heals the blind man, and it's the double healing.
Yes.
He doesn't have him wash his eyes in a pool then. He just puts it on. What's the correlation between those two and maybe the time frame? Maybe you could speak on those two.
Okay, let's see.
It's 8:24.
Yes, I know where the passage is. Okay. Let's back up to Mark 6. Mark 6, verse 30. Okay, in Mark 6, verse 30, we have the feeding of the 5,000. That's parallel to John chapter 6, verses 1 and following. Jesus walks on the sea later in in Mark chapter 6, just as he walks on the sea in John chapter 6. This corresponds then to the time where John the Baptist is put to death, and Herod Antipas wants to see Jesus, and Jesus ceased having Galilee as his base of operations. He was avoiding Herod. And so this here is going to be within the time frame of the first travel narrative in Luke, Luke 9:51 through 13:21. And so the Feast of Tabernacles is corresponding with that first trip there in Luke. So 9:51 through 13:21. So it's a different event, different place, and it says nothing here about having made clay. It's just using his spittle. And that's so. The two-stage healing there in Mark obviously was designed to make an object lesson that there are people who are blind, there are people who see, and then there are those that see well. And the Gospel of Mark is, it asks the question through the opening section up until this point of essentially, do you see? That is, who is this one that, or who but God alone can forgive sins? And what manner of man is that that the wind and the waves obey him? But the question in the second half of Mark is, how well do you see him? And that's so it's the illustration of healing the man in two stages was that the man could see but not see well, but he recognized that he didn't see well. Whereas Peter, he sees, he's able to make the confession of Jesus, but then when Jesus describes the cross, then Peter says, no way. And the issue there is, okay, Peter could see, but Peter couldn't see well. And the rest of the book is designed or is aiming at those who see coming to see Jesus well.
One other question I had, John, if they always complained about Jesus and his Pharisees, or Jesus and his disciples, breaking the Sabbath by eating grain and doing different things, how come there's no mention of him walking too far on a certain day? Because he could easily outwalk them, as you said, and then they couldn't go any farther.
Well,
what do you think on that?
I suspect that they complained about that, but it just hasn't been recorded for us by any of the gospel writers.
Good question, John. A couple questions. One of the questions, like, you know, you go back in prophetic, I can't remember if it's in Isaiah or not, but I'm going to talk about when John the Baptist had been in prison, and then he sent some of his disciples to say,
yes,
are you the one? And then there was a quote that Jesus was referring back, I think, to Isaiah, that the blind shall see, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
So this was probably another bringing forth of the Messiah's signs from that prophecy as well. In this context, I would imagine, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and then the other question is, it always behooved me how, if a parent sinned, I understand that. The parent sinned, baby was born blind, if people would think there'd be some consequence for sin, but how does a baby sin in the womb? I just don't get that part. Do you have any insight into that?
It
was just their thinking, I guess, right?
Well, the question there becomes, was it raised academically, or did they seriously think it, you know, for the disciples? In the case of the Pharisees, they were definitely wanting to blame this guy as being scum of the earth. I mean, the lowest of the low. So that any name they could have called him, they would have willingly called him it. You know, they would have choice things to say about his parents, obviously, as people are inclined to.
John,
the
issue of the walking, that was a Pharisaic ruling. It wasn't a Levitical ruling. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the Pharisaic rules just kept multiplying, but let's go to an interesting passage. Go to Matthew 18. Let's see, wait. No, that's not what I want. Matthew 19. In this passage, I'm going to argue that Jesus treats the Pharisees as representatives of the nation. He does that at other points because they have assumed a leadership position. I think they've done so as usurpers. But Matthew 12 treats them as representatives for the nation. And here I would take it also that they are treated as representatives for the nation. Now it came to pass when Jesus had finished these sayings that he departed from Galilee and came into the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. Great multitudes followed him, and he healed them there. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him, and saying to him, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason?" He gave an answer. And they didn't like his answer, so they're going to give a response. I'm more interested in their response, but in order to set that up, we'll look at his answer. "Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate.'" Jesus gave as his answer, "God did not design humanity for divorce. God designed humanity for marriage." He said, that's God's design. So they say, "Well, but well, why then did Moses command?" Too strong a term. It's, why did God allow to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? So they're saying, well, we deny that that was God's original purpose for the sake of trying to engage you in an argument. So here's the part of the passage I really wanted to get to, but I had to set this up in order to get here. Remember, I've said that Jesus is treating the Pharisees as representatives of the nation. If you ask Moses what he thought about Pharisees, Moses would say, "What's a Pharisee?" Pharisees did not come about until the about a century before the time of the Gospels. I mean, they did not come into existence before the 2nd century BC. They didn't exist in Moses' time. There was no group that was known as Pharisees in Moses' day. That was a new group that was formed. But notice, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts. He's not saying there were Pharisees in Moses' day, but he's saying, you Pharisees, I'm treating as representatives of the nation. Because of the hardness of Israel's heart, he allowed divorce. Now, hardness of heart results in multiplication of rules. Think about it. Have you ever heard of a law that forbids you to leave your wallet on the street? There's no such law. Because people are not motivated to do that. You make laws to try to stop people from doing things that they want to do. You don't make laws just to make laws. You make it because someone's doing that and you say, I don't like that. What he's saying is, God set forth the objective is for a man and a woman to remain married to each other until one or the other or both of them die. Okay, circumstances ended up developing that made it so that there was an allowance for divorce. And then there were more complications that came up, so more rules came in, and so on. Think about Moses when Jethro, his father-in-law, came to him, and he said, "You're spending your whole day working through cases. You should write this down And if you have it written down, then other people will be able to follow the guidelines and make the decision on cases that have already been set forth, and you can handle the hard ones. Well, what happened? During Moses' lifetime, there ended up being multiplication of rules because of the hardness of heart. And that process kept on continuing, and the Pharisees kept on adding rules. And Jesus is saying, essentially, it would have been enough to say, thou shalt not commit adultery, except there was hardness of heart, and this little exception required more rules, and you start multiplying rules, and you start multiplying rules. Multiplication of rules, he said, is a symptom of hardness of heart.
Thank you. Thank you. It's pretty clear.
So you wouldn't expect that passage to yield that, but I think Jesus is saying that multiplication of rules is a symptom of hardness of heart.
Okay.